From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, observers of the Supreme Court took note of the tough line of questioning directed at the Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, who was defending the health care overhaul law. Most figured the questions were an indication of how the court would eventually rule. So, can you predict the outcome of a case based on the questions in oral arguments? Some say you can, but it's complicated, this process. It isn't really so much a dialogue between the justices and the attorneys. Justice John Paul Stevens has said, really, it's the court having a conversation with itself. Today in the program, we're exploring what last week's arguments revealed about the dynamic of the Supreme Court. Not just how they'll end up ruling, but how they build coalitions and how they try and get their way within the limits of the institution. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Until the decision comes, probably in June, we're just going to have to guess how the Supreme Court is going to rule on a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. That's the law designed to overhaul the country's health care system. Observers of the court believe the justices tipped their hand in the questions they asked during oral arguments last week. Those arguments played out for 3 days. Some say the skeptical or critical questions of Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, who's defending the law, were a crucial tell that it's going to be overturned. But we wanted to know if that's true, that you can predict the outcome of a case by listening to the arguments. Today in the program, we have with us the scholar Timothy Johnson, who has analyzed thousands of cases, and he's developed a sort of model that reveals the relationship between the arguments and the outcomes. But this is more than just making a prediction. This process reveals important dynamics of how the court works, how the justices interact with each other, how they build coalitions, how they try and get their way within the framework of an institution packed with traditions and precedent. We invite you to join the conversation today. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Timothy Johnson teaches political science and constitutional law at the University of Minnesota. His book on the Supreme Court, books, I should say, on the Supreme Court include A Good Quarrel and Oral Arguments and Decision-Making on the U.S. Supreme Court. And Professor Johnson is joining us today from his home in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Timothy Johnson, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with some history that you've written about, which gives us a little bit of, context to start the conversation. You've told stories of the early days of the court when great orators like Daniel Webster would, you know, hold forth with these elaborate and impassioned speeches, much different, I guess, than what happens today. Talk about the way it used to be, I guess, first.
Sure, and I think you're absolutely right that it is very different today. When the court began in 1790, there were no such things as legal briefs. The attorneys didn't present briefs to the court, and this was in keeping in tradition, the tradition of the the English common law courts. I mean, this is where our courts originated, and more than any of the other institutions in the United States federal government, our legal system very much followed the English system, and it's no wonder why. I mean, most of the men who created our system were lawyers, and they came out of that tradition. And so there weren't these long briefs that the attorneys write before ever appearing before the court. And today, to begin in 2012, an attorney can file several different types of briefs at the court. So if you're a litigant, you will initially file, if you'd like the court to hear your case, a brief on certiorari, which is the Latin term, which essentially means, please review my case. And those briefs can be 25 pages long, but then you can add tens, if not hundreds sometimes, of pages of appendices. If the court accepts your case, you can write another 25-page brief and then add appendices. You have friends of the court who file amicus curiae briefs, and then, of course, the other side gets to file briefs. And so today, the justices literally, some cases, and in the healthcare case last week, really did have hundreds, if not several thousand, pages of legal arguments before them. Now step back to 1790 or 1800 or 1805, and those legal briefs didn't exist. And because we were still in that English tradition, all of the arguments came in open court. And so you had Daniel Webster, and you had William Wirt, and you had William Pinckney, these great orators of the day who would stand before the justices, and they would argue for 4, 8, 16 hours
wow.
before the court. Now, not all at once. They would sure. break it up, 4 hours and have lunch, and 4 hours and go home for the day, and 4 hours the next day. But, I mean, it was these very, very long orations. And so that is really how the U.S. Supreme Court began.
So we'll work through this question
sure.
in particular terms as we go. But, of course, the question comes up, why does the court continue to hear oral arguments? One of the reasons it's interesting, as you say, this is some of the only information that they themselves can control.
Well, I think that's really where I began. When I started studying the oral arguments way back in graduate school in the mid-1990s, it became very clear that the justices cannot, in most cases, control the information that they get in the briefs. I mean, they can certainly ask the attorneys to focus on particular topics, and if you look at the court's decisions when they decide to take a case, they'll sometimes tell the sides, you're limited to this question or we'd like you to add this question. But within those really broad bounds, attorneys have really wide latitude. And so when the justices really want to force an issue, when they really want to get an answer to a question that the attorneys have either A, not answered, or B, answered in a way that is not acceptable to the justices, or answered in a way that really needs clarification, then they sort of need that give and take during the oral argument. And that, to go back historically, didn't happen. When you think about the John Marshall Court or some of the courts of the mid-1800s, there were many fewer questions. And we know that not because there were transcripts of the day, but we know it from the court observers, that this really was the justices, for the most part, sitting back and saying, Daniel Webster, please orate to us what your argument is. And that's not the way it is today anymore. Hmm.
You've written it's difficult to draw connections between, you know, a justice's vote and the oral arguments. But you say that the relationship between what happens during those arguments and the legal decisions that the court eventually makes, that's really the place to uncover the influence of all of these proceedings. Talk about what interests you about that. Because it's more than just, you know, placing a bet or making a prediction. I mean, you're interested in the dynamic and the way it works, the way the court talks to itself, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are models in political science in the legal academy that can predict the outcome of a case, the court disposition. And so you could go on to many different websites today and people will tell you what they think is going to happen in Florida versus the Department of Health and Human Services, the ACA case from last week. It is, I won't say that it's easy, but it's become commonplace for scholars to be able to predict the outcome of cases. It will be 5-4. It will be 7-2. This side will win. That side will win. But what you and I both know, and I think most really astute court observers know, is that it doesn't matter who wins. Does the court affirm a lower court decision? Does it reverse it? Does it do it 5-4 or 7-2? What really matters is the legal decision that is written. Because unlike members of Congress, unlike bureaucrats in the administration, we expect our Supreme Court justices to justify the decisions that they make in these long, elaborate opinions. And whether or not we can understand them, we expect that explanation to be given. And so it's at the oral argument where you can really start assessing. And I will admit, I mean, my work shows that you can also try to make predictions through the proceedings about the outcome. Mm. But this work really tries to get more in-depth and tries to figure out what are the arguments that the justices really would like to focus on? What coalitions are building and on what issues are those coalitions building around and how are they sort of trying to make a basis for the legal or the policy choice that they will write in that ultimate majority opinion?
Because I think as you point out, they have a preference. Obviously, they have a preference, but they have a framework that they have to work in to get that heard.
This is exactly right. And the tradition that I come out of with my studies is this idea that the justices are constrained political actors.
Yeah.
And the institutional constraint that very clearly guides the justices is the quintessential institution in our nation, and that is the law.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the ways I like to explain this to my students is to say, you know, the justices cannot wake up tomorrow. They couldn't have woken up this morning on April 2nd, 2012, and said to themselves, let us today overturn the most controversial case of the 20th century, Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. There's a whole variety of reasons why they, unlike a legislator over in Congress, can't do that. One of the main ones is they wait for that case to come to them.
Yeah.
But the other is what I was just talking about, and that is the law. The law in the United States now has come to be understood as protecting a woman's right to choose. And you can like that decision, hate that decision, whatever it may be, but the justices in some large sense feel bound by that decision. And so if you jump from Roe versus Wade in 1973 to Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, you get Justice Souter, Justice Kennedy, and Justice O'Connor writing the plurality opinion for the court that says, we're actually bound by the law, and while we'd like to limit a woman's right to choose, we can't fully overturn Roe versus Wade because it has, in fact, become part of our law. Now, let me give you one better example than that and a less controversial one. Early in his tenure on the bench, Justice Rehnquist, before he became the Chief Justice, made it very clear that he did not believe in the decision Arizona versus Miranda.
Right.
And that's the decision where we get the famous phrase, you have the right to remain silent. The police have to give you this prompt before they can interview you. And Justice Rehnquist spent most of his career trying to figure out how to overturn Miranda. And when the time came, when he was Chief Justice in the early 2000s, and he had the opportunity in writing an opinion to overturn Miranda, he couldn't do it. And the reason he couldn't do it, he wrote in his opinion, was that precedent has become so inured in our psyche, within the law as well in the United States, that it is something that if we overturned would essentially make the law very chaotic in the area of police and the criminally accused relations.
So they want the process to matter.
I think that's right. They very clearly want the process to matter, and I think whether you consider yourself liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, I think the justices across the board want to, quote-unquote, get it right. They want to make sure the law is as right as humanly possible.
And one thing you point out is that the justices are goal-oriented.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Sure. What I mean by that is you can step back to my phrase 3 seconds ago, and that is liberal, conservative, Democrat, conservative. We also know that the justices are pro-choice, pro-life, pro-death penalty, anti-death penalty, pro-government expansion, anti-government expansion, any number of ways.
Yeah.
And within this constraint of the law that the justices work within, they are political actors. Now, you'll notice that I didn't use the word politician.
Yeah.
I don't believe, and I think the vast majority of legal scholars and political scientists don't believe that Supreme Court justices or even lower court judges are politicians. But they are political actors. There are certain laws they would like to see enacted. There are certain policies they would like to see carried out. And within the constraints of the law, Supreme Court justices can try to reach those goals.
There's a I wanted to talk about one case in particular that seemed just revealing about how it works these days.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the case of last week. This was you've written about the case of Horn v. Flores. It's this Arizona case related to the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. And you take note of the oral arguments in that case that occurred in April of 2009. So I wanted you to talk about this because Justice David Souter interrupted Kenneth Starr exactly, as you say, one sentence into his argument. Talk about that story, if you would, and what that reveals about the way this process works.
Sure, and this will actually take us back to your first question. And that first question is, how is this process different than it was back when the court originated in the late 1700s?
Right.
And today, and much of my work, and in fact much of the work within political science in the Legal Academy reveals similar findings. And that is that the oral argument, if you would just ask your audience what they think would happen at an oral argument, and I think I would give the same answer before I had conducted this research, and that is the attorneys would come and make their argument, like at Daniel Webster. Now, they're limited more in time today, but they still would get a chance to make their argument. And so in a case like Horn, where the justices know that there is a very salient legal policy at stake, in this case, No Child Left Behind,
right,
and they very much want to get to the heart of the matter and try to determine how they should decide that case, the justices will control the oral argument. And they will ask question after question after question, and sometimes where the attorney simply stands there, and in Horn you saw this happen, where you finally get the Chief Justice telling the attorney in the case, you're doing fine, don't worry about it. And then Justice Ginsburg saying, that last question wasn't meant for you, it was meant for someone on the bench.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, it must be, I'm just thinking of Kenneth Starr, for example. I mean, you know, now he's argued his share of cases, of course, before the court. But let's imagine then somebody else who this is their first shot up and they've spent, you know, months and months preparing a kind of narrative, right, for a case that they're going to make an argument. I wonder if they ever really do get through that argument.
It is increasingly difficult for an attorney to do that. And if you listen to all of the great appellate attorneys of today, Tom Goldstein, who runs the SCOTUSblog.com website, one of the best advocates who appears before the court today, the advice that these folks will give you, again, it doesn't matter what side they are arguing for. Think about, as well, Paul Clement, President Bush's former Solicitor General. If you would ask Paul Clement and Tom Goldstein, they'd give you the same advice as an attorney, and that is you can't come to the court expecting to give a narrative. And so really what advocates who come to the court these days will practice with are note cards that they have written on all the major cases within the issue area that they're arguing that could help them. And they'll have maybe three or four bulleted points that they would like to get to. And then they cross their fingers and hope they'll get to them because they have no control over where a case is going. And let me give you an example, not from the recent day, but from almost 60 years ago now, and that's Brown versus the Board of Education. When Thurgood Marshall, who ended up on the Supreme Court about a decade later, argued that case for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, I think he had 2 hours to make his case in 1957. Now, I'm not very good at math, but this is an easy one. 2 hours. He was asked by the justices alone 127 questions, which means that the justices spoke more than twice a minute while he was making the argument in favor of the Brown family.
Wow. It's interesting, the oral arguments, so in many ways they're conversations between the justices, as Ginsburg sort of indicated. So this leads to this question. They're not really talking to each other about the case before this. I mean, I think it was Chief Justice Roberts, who said that oral arguments, really, those are the first time that they learn what their colleagues are thinking about a case.
Very much, and Justice Kennedy has echoed this sentiment as well. I mean, a lot of folks would think, and again, I would have thought the same thing before I really spent my career studying the court, and that is that the justices take their job very seriously. And incredibly seriously. They don't believe that they should be talking about a case outside of the case. Not at a dinner party, not over drinks with friends somewhere in Washington, D.C., and certainly including not with their colleagues in the corridors of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so when the justices decide that they're going to take a case, it really is taboo for them to have discussions with one another about it before the arguments. In fact, there have been instances where the justices have even spoken just a couple of sentences to one another, and they will almost immediately send a memo to the rest of the justices saying, just so everybody knows, he and I or she and I had a discussion about the case, but we didn't really say anything. So this is absolutely right. The first time they sit and look at one another to think about a case is during the arguments. Now, former Chief Justice Rehnquist has said very clearly in the past, you know, when you're on the bench with colleagues for 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years, one gets to know where their positions are, right? You get to know that someone's more liberal or more conservative. But what they don't get to know is exactly how a justice would rule in a particular case. Hmm. I mean, I don't think anybody thought when the court decided Lawrence v. Texas, the Texas sodomy law case in 2004. I'm not sure many people thought that Justice Kennedy would side with striking down the state law. But that's because, you know, he leans right even though he's moderate. And the justices simply would have had the sense that maybe he would lean right, but they didn't know in that particular case where he would come down.
So these oral arguments, they're in this sense, they're pretty useful. It's not a waste. It's not just a conceit. I mean, they're gathering information, not just about the case, but about the way their colleagues are thinking about all of this.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And I will tell you the time that, I mean, I knew that this was probably the case. You had appellate advocates saying this. One of my favorite quotes that I won't quote directly, but it comes very close, comes from law professor Bert Newborn, who's argued his share of cases before the court. And he said one time when he was interviewed about being in oral arguments, he said, "Sometimes I feel like I'm a post person, a mail person. One justice gives me a letter through the question that she asks,
right.
And then I deliver the message to the other justice, who the first one is speaking to, through my answer. That they're trying to get to each other through me," is essentially what he was saying.
So why, though, but why does it have to be like that? If on the day after, or I'm not sure exactly how the timing works, but at some point after, they all gather in chambers together, no one but them, and then lay out the case, which I assume they did last week. Why not just use that time for that?
Sure. Here's the reason, and again, I'll refer back to Chief Justice Rehnquist when he talked about this. Now, things may be different in Roberts' court, although I suspect they're not.
Yeah.
And Chief Justice Rehnquist said at one point when he was being interviewed about conference, he said that it's a misnomer to think that those private conferences are really a good place for discussion.
Huh.
Now, it could, and I'll tell you why, but let me digress back to the arguments from last week. It could be that the conference about the healthcare cases was a long conversation.
Yeah.
But the reason Chief Justice Rehnquist made this point that it's really not a conversation is that the justices have so much to do at conference.
Hmm.
They have to get through four cases at once, the four cases that they heard in a particular week. But at the same time, simultaneously, they are continuing to hear petitions throughout the entire term for people wanting the court to take their new case.
Yeah.
So they have so many things that they have to vote on at conference that it really becomes much more of an issue where one justice says, "Here's what I feel, here's how I vote," and there's not much interaction. Then the next justice says, "Here's how I feel, here's how I vote." And because of the time constraints of conference, because the justices need to get through so many different materials and so many other cases, it just can't be like that.
Is there any chance that there's also some regard or some respect for the fact that these oral arguments are taking place in a somewhat public venue, that they're getting on record in public, not just making these decisions in private? Does that play into it at all?
Oh, I think so. And there are several scholars, more than several scholars in the academy who make this argument as well. And that is that the court really does have a public. And the largest part of the court's public is, of course, the legal community. But it also has the public at large. And the notion that this is the single most secretive branch of our government at any level of government suggests that there are times when the justices should hold proceedings, hold public proceedings, be seen, as you said, get their arguments on the record. And I'll tell you this, there are two public aspects of the court's decision-making process. One is the oral argument that we're talking about today, but the other is when the justices at the end of a term and throughout the term announce decisions from the bench. Every single decision, every opinion that you read is first announced in open court.
Mm.
And sometimes, in the rare case or the very salient case or the very controversial case, you will also have a justice announce a dissent from the bench. And so then you can also see the sparks fly during that part of the process.
Timothy Johnson is with us. He's a political science professor at the University of Minnesota. His most recent book, edited with Jerry Goldman of Northwestern University, is called A Good Quarrel. America's top legal reporters share stories from inside the Supreme Court. We invite you to join us if you have your own questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the next phase in the test for the Affordable Care Act. Last week, the Supreme Court heard hours of oral arguments over the president's health care overhaul law. And there were some pretty tough questions that came from the bench, which some say doesn't bode well for the White House. But the question is, can you really predict the outcome of a case just based on the questions or the behavior of the justices? The scholar Timothy Johnson has analyzed thousands of cases. He's developed a model that gets at this question. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about this case in particular, but more broadly, what he's learned about how the High Court really works. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Timothy Johnson, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to play a piece of tape from oral arguments. This is March of 2005. This is McCreary, Kentucky versus ACLU. It's a case related to the Ten Commandments. And I guess the question it raises for me is you're hearing Justice Scalia really not just tipping his hand, I mean, expressing how he feels about something. I mean, and he's dismissive, and I guess he can be this way, I suppose. But I guess the question is what you think this particular moment reveals about the way these dynamics work. Set this up for us first, if you would.
Sure. So you have McCreary versus the ACLU. You have a case where you had the Ten Commandments hanging in a courtroom. And so when you would enter the courtroom as a defendant or as a plaintiff, you would see the Ten Commandments sitting behind or on the wall behind the judge or to the judge's right or left. And the ACLU says that's a violation of separation of church and state. It violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And we would like the Supreme Court to make that determination and have McCreary County remove the Ten Commandments from its courtroom. And so the question in this case comes down to how do you interpret the Establishment Clause? What may a government do that has to do with religion, and what may it not do that has to do with religion?
So we're going to hear Justice Scalia, and he's interacting with David A. Friedman. He is speaking on behalf of the respondents here in this case. Here's an excerpt.
I don't think they're really saying that the particular commandments of the Ten Commandments are the basis of the Declaration of Independence. That's idiotic. What the commandments stand for is the direction of human affairs by God. That's what it stands for.
Whatever the merit of that statement, that is not what these counties have said. What these counties have said in their resolution is that the Ten Commandments are the precedent legal code of Kentucky and the central historic legal document of the state. What they have said in this display itself, in the explanation of the display, that they are the moral background of the Declaration of Independence, to the exclusion of all others, in effect. That's when you say the, it doesn't say one of. It says it is the foundation of our legal system. It doesn't say it had an influence on some of our laws. It asserts the primacy. The actual text of this display asserts the primacy of the Ten Commandments.
If that's what it means, it's idiotic. I don't think anybody is going to interpret it that way. I mean, you can't get the Declaration of Independence out of the Ten Commandments.
So, Timothy Johnson, what are you hearing there?
So what you're hearing in terms of legal argumentation is David Friedman making the argument that there's a very specific reason why the county says that it has the Ten Commandments up in a courtroom, and that is this idea of not only the Declaration of Independence, but he goes on and said that they're arguing that it's a matter of the Bill of Rights, and this is part of where we get our law from. And Justice Scalia is having none of that, and he says, look, that's not what they mean. That's not what the county wants to do. What the county wants to do is set up that this is a basis for law, and it helps us determine what is right and what is wrong, is essentially what he's coming out and saying. Mm. And then Justice Scalia really does, in some sense, get very puffed up and says, the argument you're trying to spin is absolutely wrong, and if you're telling me that argument, then we have a real problem. And, in fact, then he uses the language twice, that that's an idiotic argument. And really what he is telling the audience and telling Attorney Friedman is that here's what I think about the case. Here's how most likely I'm going to come down on this case. Not that I'm going to vote to reverse or affirm, but that I'm going to come down on the concept that it's probably okay to have the Ten Commandments in a courtroom.
And it's interesting now when you think about it in the context of today's conversation with you. Now I'm thinking about that it's not just him, you know, dressing down Mr. Friedman, but it's him sort of tipping his hand to his colleagues to say, I'm going to be a little bit passionate in the way I'm going to be addressing this, and you all, my colleagues here on the bench, should be aware of it.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And, you know, the example that I didn't think about today, but is a very good one as well, and I would commend all of your listeners to go and listen to online. You can find it, are the oral arguments in Texas versus Johnson, which is, of course, the controversial flag-burning case from 1989, the 1989 term. And Justice Scalia makes a similar argument, although he doesn't use as harsh of language as idiotic twice. But what he does do in that case, and in fact, a different way ideologically, in Texas v. Johnson, he actually dresses down the attorney for the state of Texas and really takes her to task for coming to the court and making the argument that, in fact, the flag should ever be protected by the First Amendment, that the First Amendment would stop anyone, or that the First Amendment wouldn't protect anyone if they chose to burn the American flag. And in that case, he sends a very similar signal. He does it almost as harshly, but he does it with just slightly different language.
Okay, now let's bring ourselves to last week.
Sure.
There's an exchange, the famous broccoli exchange now,
yes,
between Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General for the federal government, and Justice Scalia. Set this up for us, because I want to play this moment, too, and talk about it in the context of what we're discussing today.
Sure. So what you're going to hear is this discussion with the Solicitor General about the concept of the individual mandate. And the argument that is really at issue in this particular exchange is the concept of whether or not the federal government, and this is the heart of the case, can force a consumer to buy a particular product. We know that the government, from past cases, and this is sort of what Justice Scalia is acknowledging, we know from past cases that the government can control markets. It can control commodities. It can control almost anything to do with interstate commerce. But we have not taken that next step to say, if something is part of the market, then the government can force you to buy what is in the market. And that's sort of where the broccoli shtick comes in.
Mm. Here, we'll hear first from the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, and then, of course, Justice Scalia.
Virtually everybody in society is in this market, and you've got to pay for the health care you get. The predominant way in which it's paid for is insurance, and the respondents agree that Congress could require that you have insurance in order to get health care or forbid health care from being provided.
Why do you define the market that broadly? Health care. It may well be that everybody needs health care sooner or later, but not everybody needs a heart transplant. Not everybody needs a liver transplant.
That's correct, but you never know whether you're going to
Could you
that
define
person.
The market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later, so you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
No, it's quite different. It's quite different.
Does he really care what the answer is, Scalia?
You know, I'm not sure that he cares what the answer is in that case, although in some sense he does. And the reason that Justice Scalia cares is that he is on record in a recent case, Reich, R-A-I-C-H, versus Gonzalez, which is the court's decently controversial case on the use of medicinal marijuana in California from several terms ago. And in that case, Justice Scalia was in the majority that said, because marijuana, even though it's illegal according to federal law, because it is a commodity that is sold within a market, the federal government may in fact regulate it. And so I think from a legal standpoint, what he's trying to do with that sort of line of questioning is to determine where that line is. Can you regulate it because it's economic, because it's a market, or is there a line that says you can't take that next step and force someone to buy a particular product? So I think in that sense, he does care because he needs to get that information from both sides, in this case from Solicitor General Verrilli, to determine where the line might be. On the other hand, I think your question is a really good one, and that is he may not care, because if he is simply sending a signal to his colleagues in this case, and I suspect he's probably doing both things,
right.
He is now saying, I've told you, and that you all can listen to me now, you other eight colleagues of mine, and that is the line has been drawn, and this argument is ridiculous, and I couldn't support it.
Here's an email from Jonathan who writes, when I'm making a decision, it helps me a lot to have discussions back and forth and hear both sides of an argument. Would we get better or different decisions from the court if they had the opportunity for more interaction? If so, what changes do you think could accomplish something like that?
You know, I don't know. Given that I'm not a psychologist, and I can't give an exact answer to that question, but in some sense, I think what you would maybe get are arguments where the justices are able to, or where the attorneys are able to really flesh out their argument to the justices, and maybe, as the old adage goes, you could win a case at oral argument more likely than usually you would lose a case at the argument. I think that there are ways you could actually test this. This is a very good question, because in lower courts, you can go across, say, in the lower appellate courts, and there are different oral argument rules across our 12 circuit courts in the United States.
Right.
And I think you could really take a good hard look at those courts that ask more questions on average versus those that ask fewer questions. So I don't know exactly what the difference would be. I suspect there might be a difference, but it is a testable hypothesis.
Timothy Johnson is with us. He teaches political science and constitutional law at the University of Minnesota. His most recent book is called A Good Quarrel. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring what last week's oral arguments revealed about the dynamic of the Supreme Court, not just how they'll end up ruling, but how they build coalitions and how they try and get their way within the limits of that institution. Our guest is the scholar Timothy Johnson. He's a political science professor at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book most recently. He has a number of books. His most recent one is called A Good Quarrel. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wanted to get to the model that you've been working with to sort of assess all of this. First of all, how would you characterize the tenor of the oral arguments that you heard last week? What did you get from that?
I think that there was a lot of skepticism, and you really got that from the five more conservative justices on the bench. And they really wanted to probe, if you will, how exactly it is that you could have this law that might go so far beyond what the Commerce Clause has allowed Congress to do in the past. And so if you would ask me, and you didn't, but I'll put words in your mouth, to boil this down to one type of descriptive word, and that would be skepticism.
So explain how the model works and what you're looking for, because essentially you're keying on you're trying to get at emotions in some way? You're looking for particular words?
Very much so. And so there has been a long line of literature written in linguistics and in psychology, I mean, over the past several decades, and more than that, you know, three, four, five decades, where scholars have tried to determine how you can understand human decision-making, not justice decision-making, but human decision-making through the emotions that you reveal through the words that you use. And in fact, we've used at this point a pretty blunt instrument, and that instrument at this point is really just the words on the written page. We have not begun to code the content of justices, what their voices sound like, and we know we can do so. It's just a very difficult process. So what we have done so far is used what you would call a linguistics dictionary. And it was a dictionary created by a linguist at Laurentia University in Canada about, well, over the past 20 years, she's been creating this dictionary. And it's a dictionary of words that she has and been able to code as either pleasant words or unpleasant words or active words or inactive words to get a scale of human emotion. And so what we can do is use her dictionary within a computer program and put all of these thousands of oral argument transcripts into that same computer program, and it can tell us the types of words the justices are using when they are talking to each other and talking to the attorneys at oral argument. Now, the key to this is none of the justices use an overwhelming number of pleasant words or unpleasant words, but they use enough that you can get some sort of a handle on what side they seem to be leaning towards and which side they seem to be leaning against.
So I guess idiotic is pretty easy.
Idiotic is very easy.
But yes. What happens when you have, you know, justices who are a little bit more artful in the way, maybe passive-aggressive even? You know, I mean, how do you account for that?
No, in fact, that's a very good question. And currently, we don't account for that for the simple reason that the other really interesting part about this dictionary we use is that it does not look at the words in context. Mm-hmm. It only looks at the words individually. But what makes us very happy about what we've been able to explain on the U.S. Supreme Court is that this measure may not be the best measure for understanding the language justices use in particular, but we're still able to explain a large portion of the cases that they decide. Our hypothesis, and this is what we're gathering data for now, is that when we get the more nuanced measure, when we have measures of voice intonation, sarcasm, anger, humor, sadness that comes straight out of your mouth, we'll actually even get better predictions for how the justices are going to act in a case.
Well, that's interesting because what it says is these are very bright individuals. There are still tells in the words that they use. I mean, you know, even you don't have to account for body language, as you said, for sarcasm, tone, any of that. Just the words themselves are telling.
That's absolutely right. I mean, what it tells us, and this is really how I teach it to my undergraduate students as well. The justices on the U.S. Supreme Court are just human beings like you and me. Mm. And, you know, the old cliche, they put their pants on one leg at a time. They are nine of the best legal minds in the entire world, but they still have human traits that can be used to understand how they're going to act.
All right, I want to take another example from last week's oral argument. This is Justice Kennedy talking to Donald Verrilli again. I'm not. Maybe you can help me set this up. But what I want you to sort of say is what you're hearing in this that you could plug into the model. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is an exchange between Justice Kennedy and the Solicitor General Donald Verrilli. Anything else to say about this setup?
You know, this is just the classic Justice Kennedy sitting on the fence, and he does it at oral argument just like he does when the court hands down decisions, and he's trying to get the Solicitor General to really give him some reason that he should maybe vote in favor of the ACA.
Here we'll hear first from Justice Kennedy.
Would you help me with this? Assume for the moment, you may disagree, assume for the moment that this is unprecedented. This is a step beyond what our cases have allowed, the affirmative duty to act to go into commerce. If that is so, do you not have a heavy burden of justification? I understand that we must presume laws are constitutional. But even so, when you are changing the relation of the individual to the government in this, what we can stipulate is, I think, a unique way, do you not have a heavy burden of justification to show authorization under the Constitution?
So, two things about that, Justice Kennedy. First, we think this is regulation of people's participation in the healthcare market. And all this minimum coverage provision does is say that instead of requiring insurance at the point of sale.
Okay, so Donald really goes on. And I'm keying on Timothy Johnson, things like Justice Kennedy saying, assume for a moment that this is unprecedented. This is a step beyond. Do you not have a heavy burden of... I mean, it's very gentle. It's not at all like what you'd hear from Scalia. But he is tipping his hand to some degree. Can you code for this particular exchange, for example?
Yes, and while our initial model that we use would not necessarily pick all of this up as maybe being a negative argument, what we would pick up in the more nuanced measure that we're beginning to work with is this idea of that hypothetical that you are pointing out that says, I'm skeptical of this. And then the other argument where he actually uses the double negative. Right. And he says, or he starts out in a negative fashion, do you not have this heavy burden of proof?
Huh.
And you sort of get coming through there when you listen to his voice as well, this idea of really, really strong level of skepticism about the argument that Verrilli is making.
You know, the one question that I wondered about, do the justices always reveal their hand? I mean, is part of the interaction playing the devil's advocate? I mean, I know that their colleagues know, as Chief Justice Rehnquist suggested, you know where they're going, but can you account for the devil's advocate part of the conversation?
I think you very much can. And it gets more tricky to do so, but there are times where you can sit and read that transcript or listen to the transcript, the audio of the transcript, and you can say that's exactly what a justice is doing.
Yeah.
More often than not, however, you have justices who are asking questions or making statements in a positive manner to the side that they support and giving a really hard time to the side with which they disagree.
So no one's that tricky.
You know, sometimes they can be, but no. And in fact, I would say the one who would be that tricky is Justice Kennedy.
Huh.
And that's only Justice Kennedy oftentimes not wanting to reveal his hand. And while his colleagues might be able to know that he's tipping his hand in a particular way, he oftentimes wants to hold back until he does get to conference. And that's why I would argue that the supporters of the ACA, the administration in particular, shouldn't be as upset about the arguments that took place on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. Now, I'm not saying that they will uphold the ACA, but Justice Kennedy oftentimes has a way of being very harsh on one side at oral argument and then coming out on the other side. And that's where your argument about the devil's advocate would come in most clearly.
So what were you hearing from Chief Justice Roberts? And I'm wondering, as a Chief Justice, I'm thinking back at what you were talking about from Rehnquist in the precedent case in the Miranda story. Does he have to temper his ideological persuasions in the interest of the court's, you know, reputation? I mean, that's his responsibility.
Very much so. And I think that the Chief Justice in this case is in a very difficult position. I mean, he promised that the court would be much more collegial. He promised that the justices would be able to work together much more strongly than they had in the late Rehnquist court. But we have seen, while that took place initially in the 2005 term when he took over the court, we've seen that decrease and the number of 5-4 decisions increase in the court, especially in highly salient, highly controversial cases. And being a judicial conservative, now let me caution your listeners that I'm not talking about an ideological conservative. I'm talking about a judicial conservative,
right,
which the Chief Justice is,
yeah,
and that is a judge or a justice who wants to rule on as narrow ground as humanly possible. He doesn't want the court to be a super legislature.
Mm.
And so you could listen to him at these oral arguments looking for a way to say, well, you know, I might really agree that we should strike down the ACA. On the other hand, or the individual mandate portion of the ACA, on the other hand, I want to look for a way to preserve the law that Congress passed and be true to that law as much as humanly possible. In essence, the chief seems to be looking for a way to have his cake and eat it, too.
So I won't ask you for a prediction, Professor Johnson, but I did want to, and I know you haven't done a full analysis yet on this case. I imagine you haven't anyway, but what kinds of conclusions are you drawing early on?
You know, I think a few. One is that you can take from the argument on Monday where the court was determining whether or not it could even hear the case that the justices almost across the board, across the ideological spectrum, across the seniority spectrum, believe that they have the power, they have the jurisdiction to hear this case. And I also think that when you combine the argument from Tuesday and Wednesday about the individual mandate, about this issue that is more difficult for everybody in the world to understand, severability, including myself, you get the sense that the justices want to compromise and that there could be, and I'm not making predictions, but there could be five votes to say we'll strike the individual mandate, but we need to keep those portions of the law that do, for example, allow kids to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 25. Mm. We need to keep the portion of the law that says pre-existing conditions can no longer be used to discriminate against people with these medical conditions. And so I think what you're going to get is some sort of compromise.
Let me ask you finally once a question maybe that's more broad than that. In what way, through your analysis, in what way are you seeing the Roberts Court evolve? Is it headed in some kind of direction that you can tell?
You know, I think the Roberts Court, unlike what the Chief Justice said he would do and what I think he desperately wants, I think it is getting more ideologically polarized, and that is you are getting more and more of the 5-4 decisions. You can see it not only in the opinions that are issued, but you can see it at the oral argument. And I think ultimately, depending on what happens in November of this year, you will get a court that will continue to be polarized. And the only way that you sort of break that 5-4 logjam is that if President Obama wins another term, and he's able to replace two of the justices, and that would assume replacing one in the conservative bloc. Now, you'd continue with the polarization, but it's possible that it mitigates itself a little bit depending on how liberal or how moderate the justices are that he would get to nominate, if, in fact, he would even have that opportunity.
That's Timothy Johnson. He's a political science professor at University of Minnesota. His most recent book is called A Good Quarrel. He joined us from his home in Minneapolis. Professor Johnson, thanks very much for the time.
It was my pleasure. It was great to be here.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.